Today at Reader's Corner, Mark Levinson, author of The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Grocery shopping is on almost everyone's weekly list. And for many households, that means driving to the supermarket or an even larger discount megastore and loading our carts to the brim with our favorite brands. But grocery shopping wasn't always this way. A century ago, small mom-and-pop grocers dotted street corners staffed by storekeepers who packaged bulk items for customers they knew by name. Today, the retail landscape continues to change as more of us go online for a variety of purchases. In his book, The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America, Mark Levinson offers an insightful look at the history of the grocery business by chronicling the rise and fall of what once was the world's largest retailer. It's a story that has special resonance in Boise, Idaho, the birthplace and home of Albertsons, one of the largest food and drug retailers in the United States. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mark Levinson. He is a former finance and economics editor of The Economist in London, a former business reporter for Time and Newsweek, and the author of a number of other books, including The Box, How the Shipping Container Made the World Smaller and the World Economy Bigger. He joins us from studios in Washington, D.C. for this interview. Mark Levinson, welcome to Reader's Corner.
It's good to be with you, Bob.
Mark, take us all the way back to those days when grocery shopping was very different, as I alluded to in my introduction. My wife's grandfather was with Piggly Wiggly, and she was telling me that her grandfather would remember those days when people would bring their list into this little small mom-and-pop store and just hand it over. Is that what they did? And then folks got these dry goods? Is that the way it worked in those
early days? Well, in the early days, back until about 1890, you didn't really have what we think of as grocery shopping today because you didn't have branded packaged goods. You would go into the grocery store and you would buy a pint of molasses or a pound of sugar, and it would be given to you in a bag or a bucket, and you were not buying brand name merchandise. The modern concept of shopping began to develop really only in the 1890s after we had advancements in packaging and canning that made it possible to have a product with a name on it. So now you could go looking for Campbell's soup or Kellogg's cereal or that sort of thing. And that was followed really by the growth of mom-and-pop grocery stores all over the country. They would buy this merchandise in small quantities from a succession of wholesalers. So there tended to be a very long and complicated supply chain with everyone taking a piece of the action. And for the consumer, this, of course, ended up being quite expensive because you had a wholesaler who might be supplying a few cans of this or a few boxes of that to the retailer, and the retailer only selling a small quantity of merchandise. And so the costs were really quite high. And that's what grocery shopping was like. It really began to change the early part of the 20th century when there started to be smaller chains that could buy in some volume from the manufacturers. My story really takes off in 1912 when the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, which owned a bunch of stores in a chain, and these were small, had the idea that maybe they could reduce costs by limiting hours, by reducing the selection in the store, by reducing personnel, and passing the savings on to customers. And that really shook up the retailing industry. So between 1912 and 1920, the Great Atlantic and Pacific, A&P, went from having a few hundred stores to several thousand stores. And in 1920, by the end of World War I, it had become the largest retailer in the world.
And so they were buying by volume, I would assume, thereby reducing the cost of the product. Is that correct?
They were buying by volume, and they had the idea that they could save costs by pumping more through each store. Now, this requires a bit of deviation into the thinking of those times. In general, the thinking in retailing was that you should aim for what they called a profit, which is what we would call a markup. So if you bought something as the grocer for 10 cents and you sold it for 12 cents, you'd made a 20% profit. That's what the thinking was. And you were doing very well. The brothers who controlled A&P, that was John and George Hartford, said, no, 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 this is all wrong. You're not interested in the markup. You're interested in the return on investment. And so if you take a smaller markup, you're pumping more merchandise through your store. You're getting more customers in and having more revenue as a result. And so you're getting a higher return on your investment, even though you're making less money on each individual item. And for the 19-teens, that was really revolutionary thinking. That was a totally different way of looking at retailing.
You talk about two inventions that were critical to A&P's ability to diversify from a tea and coffee company to a supermarket. Help us understand the cardboard box and the tin can.
Sure. Back until about the 1880s or so, when you bought food in a can, and you could buy food in a can, but that can was probably handmade. Can making was a very skilled art, and so canned food was quite expensive. It was a delicacy. And by the way, you could have some pretty yucky stuff mixed in with your food because the cans were hand-soldered. And so you might get your tuna fish with a little zinc added in or something like that. It wasn't very nice. And cardboard boxes were also quite expensive. They were often custom-made for a particular purpose, had to be hand-printed. And so they were really only used for luxury goods. And it was the invention, by accident, of an inexpensive process for making cardboard boxes and printing them that made it possible to have this explosion of brand names in the store. I mean, think how you would present your brand to the public if you didn't have a way of creating a package with the brand name plastered all over it.
You mentioned the Hartford brothers, who really were the originators of the A&P that we knew over the years. Tell us a little bit about them and how long they reigned, the impact they had on the business.
Sure. The A&P was actually founded by a guy named George Gilman, who was very much a showman. He was a merchandiser back in the time of the Civil War. And he'd brought in a man named George H. Hartford to be his business manager. Unlike Gilman, George H. Hartford was a very sober, organized guy who kept the trains running, as it were, and made sure that the operation was profitable. And Hartford ended up having control of half the business and effectively running it when Gilman took himself out of the business. He had two sons, George L. Hartford and John A. Hartford. George L. was born in the 1860s and John in around 1880. And they came into the business and slowly took it over. They ended up running the business together until the 1950s. When their father died, he put the business in a trust, and they were the trustees. So they had total control. This was not a publicly traded company, so the brothers could do whatever they wanted in running the business. As it happened, George L. was the finance guy. He was a financial wizard. He was also a very conservative guy. John was the marketer. John was the one who was saying, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. Trends are changing. We've got to keep up with the customer. And he would come up with these brilliant ideas, and George would say, well, but how do we make money off that? How do we make sure we make a profit? And so these two brothers together formed quite a management team, and they really managed the company between them from the 1880s into 1950.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. Our guest today is Mark Levinson, author of The Great A&P, which chronicles the rise and fall of what once was the largest retailer in the world. I hate to get ahead of the story here, Mark, but since you've mentioned the prowess of these two brothers, when they pass on, the company goes through some reorgs, some new leadership. And my recollection is from reading your book that the CFO type takes over, and the grocer emphasis that John Hartford had on the company gets lost somewhere along the line. Is that a fair characterization of one of the reasons why A&P got off the rails down the road?
It is. It is. Now, the Hartford brothers, between them, controlled this entire company, lock, stock, and barrel. But it was a huge company. And one of the things that is very interesting in reading through the records about this company is that even though the Hartfords controlled it, they had to constantly fight to change it because they had a lot of managers who were happy the way things were. They didn't really want change. Well, John A. Hartford, when he was alive, could bang the table and say, we've got to change. We've got to do this. It's urgent. Once he died, there was nobody to do that. And so it just became a very conservative company. It became quite stuck in its ways.
Well, you mentioned that the Hartford brothers had a fight to change. They had to fight in a number of ways. And one of the most important ways they had to fight was to fight off the federal government. And of course, this seems to be the gist of your book, that usually when the federal government gets involved in business disputes, it's to protect the consumer. It's to make sure that businesses aren't walking away with the profits and the consumer isn't suffering. But in this particular case, over the years, with FDR and Wright-Patman, you have the federal government really coming down on the A&P because, what, it was offering products that were too reasonably priced.
Well, you had the federal government and state governments all over the country and local governments all over the country. And they were all trying to protect the small merchant and the small wholesaler from the unfair practices of these giant merchandisers. And what unfair meant was offering a low price, a lower price than someone thought should be offered. Starting in the 1920s, you had states all over the country putting a penalty tax on a chain store. So there would be a tax structure that looked something like this. You'd pay $5 for your first store in a state, and then $10 each year for the second store, and then $20 each year for the third store, and then $50 each year for the fourth and fifth store. Well, if you were a company like the Great Atlantic and Pacific, which at one point owned 16,000 stores, those sorts of taxes added up pretty fast. And the purpose of those taxes, flat out, was to make it expensive for chain stores to do business. The federal government stepped in several ways. One of them was with a law that prohibited manufacturers from granting volume discounts to retailers.
Was that the grocery code?
No, that was called the Robinson-Patman Act.
Oh, of course.
It was passed in 1936. Mm-hmm. And here the idea was that fair, quote unquote, means that each retailer has the right to purchase the goods from the manufacturer at the same price. So here you've got a mom-and-pop grocery store that's buying a case of tomato sauce, and you've got a firm like the A&P, which is buying tomato sauce by the railroad carload, and they were each supposed to pay the same price per can. This, again, was meant to drive up prices for customers and to keep big firms, of which A&P was the biggest, from discounting.
So this really was, in the sense of philosophical battle, that you could probably take back to Thomas Jefferson's thinking about small-town America?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You would go into small towns and you would have the Chamber of Commerce, believe it or not, the Chamber of Commerce warning against doing business with foreign companies. Well, foreign companies meant, in those days, companies that might be based in, say, New York or Chicago. The idea was that you were supposed to do business with a local company. And what you had was a lot of small businesses and small towns fearing for their existence. The argument was that, well, the small grocer has his managers living in the town. If there's a wholesaler nearby, the people who run the wholesaler are living there. So you've got all kinds of jobs in the community. You've got taxpayers in the community. The chain stores, executives and managers live someplace else. It's warehouses or someplace else, and their managers live someplace else. So you're depriving the community of these resources. And so this was, to some extent, a battle of small towns versus big cities, as well as a battle of small stores versus big ones.
But ultimately, of course, the winner, as far as A&P is concerned, is the consumer who gets these lower prices. And I must say, as I got to this part of your book, I couldn't help think of today and the kind of upper middle class bias against Walmart, which is, I think, in fact, you call A&P the Walmart of its day. And here we have a company today that, again, according to upper middle class thinking, is ripping off Main Street America, and therefore we have to limit their influence. Could you compare or contrast? What's different? What's alike about what A&P was going through? We read your book today and we say, oh, A&P was in the right and they were trying to make products less costly for consumers. They were opening up new markets, and we pat A&P on the back historically. But I don't think we've patted Walmart on the back very often. Why the difference, and is there any reason for that difference?
There are a lot of similarities between the A&P story and the Walmart story. Now, one difference is that Walmart itself hasn't manufactured anything, whereas A&P was also a major manufacturer of food. But A&P's ideas about how to run a supply chain were very similar to Walmart's. A&P had bakeries. A&P had canneries. A&P had dairies. A&P could go to a macaroni manufacturer and say, we think we know how much it costs to make an 8-ounce package of macaroni, and we're prepared to give you this price for your macaroni. If you don't want to produce it at this price for us, we'll make it ourselves. So A&P was a master at squeezing the supply chain. Walmart was accused of doing much the same in much more recent times, that it was not offering a fair price, as people called it, to its suppliers. A&P was definitely accused of driving local merchants out, creating a situation in which everything would be run by giant corporations. Walmart, of course, has been accused of much the same thing. So I think there are really a lot of similarities in the A&P story and the Walmart story.
Let's talk a little bit about the downfall of A&P. In a sense, it really wasn't about the federal government as much as it was about internal decisions made by A&P. So I'm going to run through two or three of these, and you can comment on each of them. The failure to buy their own real estate as opposed to leasing. These, by the way, sound to me like a great business case for a business school class. Let's start with the failure to buy real estate.
The A&P had traditionally leased its stores. And back in 1928, George L. Hartford had been uncomfortable with how frothy the economy was getting. And he'd sent out a directive to all his managers saying we should only have 1-year leases because I think something's wrong with the economy here. Well, that was brilliant. When the Great Depression came, rents fell a whole lot, and A&P did very well because it only had 1-year leases. Fast forward to the 1950s. The Hartfords were out of the picture, but managers were still going by the principles that George Hartford had established in 1929. So now real estate developers would come along. This was the age of the suburban expansion, the creation of these shopping centers out on the highway outside of town. And they'd say to A&P, we're building this new shopping center. We'd love to have you be part of it. Would you join us? A&P would say to them, well, sure, we'll take a 1-year lease. And the developers would say, no, that's not the way it works anymore. We're not going to do business with you with a 1-year lease. A&P didn't want to own the property. It didn't want to be tied up in a 1-year lease, in a long-term lease. And as a result, it did not get the good sites when we had the suburban growth of the 1950s and 1960s.
Well, I told you before we started talking that I grew up in St. Louis, and I had A&P on one end of my neighborhood and Kroger on the other. So as a Midwesterner, I knew A&P like the back of my hand. Meanwhile, out west, A&P known not so much. And that's the second thing I'd like you to talk about, the failure to capture the California market, to understand the potential of the California market and the role that the brothers may have played in that.
This is really an incredible story when you think about it. A&P had started opening stores in California back in the 1930s, and it had a bunch of them through the 40s and 50s. And then in the 1950s, it talked about should it expand in California? Should it open a lot more stores? And the decision was made not to. For whatever reason, The California stores administratively had always been part of A&P's New York division. And the managers at A&P, the executives, just decided that California is too far away. We don't really know what's going on out there. So maybe we should just get out rather than expanding. Well, California was the fastest growing state in the United States by population in every decade between 1950 and 2000. And so A&P simply walked away from the fastest growing market in the country. Pretty amazing, but that's part of their downfall.
And at a time when perhaps they should have been reinvesting in the business, tell us about their dividends.
This company went public in the late 1950s. It was hugely unprepared to be a publicly traded company. It had always been privately held by the trust that was controlled by the Hartford brothers until their deaths. And so no one at A&P had ever worked for a company that's shares were traded on the stock market. They were not used to investors asking questions. They were not used to shareholders demanding dividends. So now that they were publicly traded, shareholders had a right to an opinion. And the opinion was, we want more dividends out of this company. Well, A&P complied. And it started to pay out generous dividends, which meant that there was less money available to reinvest in the stores. So by the early 1960s, you started seeing complaints that the A&P stores were looking dim, they were looking dingy, they weren't looking as modern as the stores down the block. And that was clearly a result of this decision to pay money out to shareholders in the form of dividends rather than to put it back into the business.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm speaking with Mark Levinson, author of the book The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. You describe the Hartford's business strategy with the phrase creative destruction. What does that mean in the grocery industry?
The Hartfords remade their business four times in the course of their lives, turning it from a tea and coffee store into a grocery store, turning it into a low-cost grocery store that, as I said, became the largest in the world, going from there to what was called a combination store, which involved having meat and produce be part of their business. That was not normal in the 1920s, but A&P started to do that. And then making the transition to supermarkets in the late 1930s, when, of course, A&P became the largest supermarket retailer in the world. So they forced this sort of change. And they often had to demand that their managers do it. For example, their managers really didn't want to do supermarkets. Why not? Well, because every supermarket, it was clear, would replace five or six smaller stores. And that meant that maybe some managers would lose their jobs or some employees might have to be laid off. And so we don't really want to do that. And the Hartfords had to insist. Well, they did remake their company four times. Fast forward now to the 2000s. What do you do if you are a company like Walmart? You've got changing consumer tastes. You've built several thousand super centers out on the edge of town. And these super centers do a big business in groceries. But now you've got more customers who don't want to go to the super centers. They want a faster experience. They want to get in and out. They don't want to have to walk past the auto parts and the TV sets to get a jug of milk. And how do you change your business when you've got changing tastes, but you've got such a large investment in the business you've got? It's a tough order. It's very difficult for a big company to do. And that's really what A&P struggled with from the 1950s when it stopped changing its business. It just kept on doing what it was doing.
And perhaps I didn't get specific enough when we were talking about the role the federal government played in attacking A&P for lowering its prices and being more competitive. I mean, in 1946, the A&P and the Hartford brothers were actually convicted on criminal antitrust charges brought by the Justice Department. Walk us through what that was about, how that happened. I mean, that just sounds so outrageous that a company trying to do its best to be competitive and lower prices for consumers winds up getting federally indicted and convicted?
Yes, they were convicted of restraint of trade for selling groceries too cheaply. And it's pretty hard to understand this today. But there are some really bizarre economic theories behind this. I'll just give you an example of one. So if a manufacturer is selling cheaply to A&P because it's buying at such volume, then in order to break even on that deal, it must have to inflate the price to which at which it sells to other retailers. Now, if you think about it for a minute, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, the manufacturer will sell to other retailers at whatever price it can get, and that's not likely to have anything to do with the price paid by A&P. But there was the contention, which the court thought reasonable, that A&P's demand for discounts was driving up prices for other retailers. Kind of bizarre. A&P had a big produce business. Actually, some of it was in Idaho, that bought produce from around the country, sold it to A&P stores, and sold it also to outside companies, outside grocers that wanted to buy produce from A&P. And so, again, the argument was made that somehow A&P is driving up the price of produce or is monopolizing the best produce for itself and selling bad produce to other grocers. Well, I mean, there are plenty of produce dealers around the country, and if a retailer thought it wasn't getting good produce from A&P, it could easily go and get produce from somebody else. There was no way A&P was going to monopolize the potato business, but that was the sort of claim that was made. So, yes, you had the federal government absolutely weighing in on the side of the small businesses and against the interests of consumers who benefited from lower prices.
Well, A&P's latest incident with the federal government was just last July when, for the second time, they filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and that included selling 76 stores to a company, I believe, in Philadelphia, and I think they also sold something to Albertsons. Walk us through what's happened to A&P just in these last few years. In fact, obviously, some of these things have happened since you wrote your book, which has a 2011 printing date on it. There is no A&P today as we knew it in its smaller form, even when your book came out?
November 2015 is actually the end of the line for A&P.
I see.
The company is closing up its doors. For many years, this company has been shrinking. It used to be coast to coast. It was in almost every state. And it began retreating from one state after another after another. It was the world's largest coffee importer at one point. It sold off its coffee business early in the last decade. It sold off its warehouses. By 2000, it had really just become a regional retailer, and by 2010, it was really just around New York and Philadelphia. When it filed for bankruptcy the second time in 2015, it had about 300 stores left, and some of those have been closed. Some of those have been sold off. By that point, this was a company with negative brand value. Okay, most of its stores didn't carry the A&P name because, frankly, shoppers did not attach good things to the A&P name. That's how far down this company went.
Is it safe to say that when you look back on the history of A&P, notwithstanding the role the federal government played to slow it up over the years, it really wasn't done in by the federal government as much as it was really done in by itself and the changing marketplace?
A&P was definitely done in by itself and by its inability to change. But A&P was a very important company in U.S. business history. This was the company that introduced the idea of discount retailing to America. This was the company that really promoted the idea that consumers could benefit if you sold more goods at a lower price, that that was the future. And that really shaped American retailing in the first half of the 20th century.
Well put. Mark, we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us today. Again, the title of the book is The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. Our guest today has been Mark Levinson. Thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner, Mark.
Thank you, Bob. I've enjoyed being with you.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Mark Levinson. Next week, Michael McCarthy, author of Ashes Underwater, the SS Eastland and the Shipwreck that Shook America. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Brady Moore. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.